We'll just continue from Sunday morning. Canto 3, chapter 29, text 28. So the chapter is explanation of devotional service. Where we ended up the other morning, Sunday morning, that ended a section, this verse, this morning's verse is starting a new section. It's still connected to devotional service. But the previous section was, in devotional service, the importance of coming to the position where we can not only see God is in the place of worship, in the deity, or in the church, or the synagogue, or the mosque, or the temple, but seeing God, or super soul, along with the individual soul within the heart of every living being, and therefore respect and appropriate to the person's position, or living entity's position. Regarding that body that they're inhabiting as the temple of God. During the flight from Washington DC to Boston on Saturday morning, there was a young fellow that sat next to me, and he was doing his thing. He had a friend up in the front. They were kind of like back and forth. But he was a little curious and started asking about, you know, the dhoti and the clothing. And specifically, his attention right away went to the tilak and the meaning. Did I share this? Is that right? So is there some significance of that mark on your forehead? And I said, yes, it marks the body as a temple of God. And that, you know, his sound vibration was, So that meant, you know, can you say something more? So I said something more. Just like when you see a building that has a cross on the top, that means it's a church. And inside the church, it's a place, a house of worship. Or over there's a mosque, and they have a certain mark at the top of the mosque, and then you know that's a place of Allah, and it's a place of worship. Or over there is the Star of David, and that's a place of worship of Jewish people. So similarly, as there's temples and churches and mosques, our teaching says the body is a temple, because God is within. There's a form within. And therefore, we should treat the body accordingly. And not only we should treat our body accordingly, that means what goes in the church or what comes out should be accordingly. What goes in and what comes out should be representative of this is the temple of God. And then we should see others that way too. That was, So that was the previous section. It was in relation to the context was in terms of deity worship and how to see the deity worship and do the deity worship in proper manner, at the same time respecting others that aren't a deity, but the form of the Lord is within other living beings also. That's way beyond just, you're not this body. The essence of Samkhya, because Samkhya is his teaching. Samkhya is the analysis of matter and spirit. That's already been done. At the end of that chapter 26, it was fix the mind. And now that this is clear, the soul is who we are and not matter covering the soul, then next is fix the mind upon the Supreme Soul. And connect the individual soul to the Supreme Soul, because that's what yoga is. Connect the individual soul to the Supreme Soul. that's now just that understanding, chapter 26, has been expanded in chapter 29. When engaging in devotional service, whether it's deity worship or whatever, when we're doing whatever we do that's in service to Krishna, cultivate the consciousness, at least conceptually or notionally understand God is within. And if you act with that proper knowledge, then as he says, gradually, therefore, through charitable gifts and attention, as well as through friendly behavior and by viewing all to be alike, one should propitiate me, who abides in all creatures as their very self. Anyway, the notes, the previous verses, gradually come to that position. Yeah. Performing his prescribed duties, one should worship the deity of the Supreme Personality of Godhead until one realizes my presence in his own heart and in the hearts of other living entities as well. The process of devotional service is to get one to that realization. And before you have the realization, at least knowledge of that reality, we're not seeing it, we're not perceiving it, we're not experiencing it. It's reality beyond our experience, but that's reality. And by the process of devotional service, covering can be removed, and that gradually that realization can come. And that's a nice culture where people are respecting one another, not just because it's nice to do so, but it's because that's reality. Then there's coverings where this behavior is according to this mode of nature, and that behavior is according to that mode of nature, and the modes change and behaviors change. And so the ever-changing picture of what's out there goes on. Then there's this ultimate reality. So we conduct ourselves according to the configurations of matter appropriately, based upon the consciousness that super soul is within the heart, and ultimately respect. We love the person, the soul, even though the behavior may or may not be so lovable, may be far from the mode of goodness or far from harmony with divine. We can still respect the individual soul and, to our best ability, act in a mood of service to them. So now this moves to another section, starting with 28. In different species of life, there's different grades of consciousness or stages of evolved consciousness. So this verse is speaking of the human form of life, and below that is animals, and consciousness becomes more covered and more covered as the species go downward. So here's text 28. Living entities are superior to inanimate objects, like dull matter. And among them, the living entities who display life symptoms are better. So apparently there's living entities present everywhere that don't display life symptoms. Animals with developed consciousness are better than them, and better still are those who have developed sense perception. So Prabhupada is going to explain in the purport this living entities that don't display life symptoms. I'll read that paragraph first, although it's paragraph number 2 in the purport. The first division is made between dead, stone-like matter and the living organism. A living organism is sometimes manifested even in stone. It gives examples. Experience shows that some hills and mountains grow. This is due to the presence of the soul within that stone. Above that, the next manifestation of the living condition is development of consciousness. And the next manifestation is the development of sense perception. In the Moksha Dharma section of the Mahabharata, it is stated that trees have developed sense perception, semicolon. They can see and smell. Maybe you didn't know that, huh? I didn't know that either. We can know by experience that trees can see. How's that? Sometimes, in its growth, a large tree changes its course of development to avoid some hindrances. Grows towards the sun. If there's a block, then it'll grow towards the sun. No block. This means that a tree can see. And according to Mahabharata, a tree can also smell. Doesn't give an example. Now, this is chapter 29. Going back to 26, there's five elements: earth, water, fire, air, ether, and the sense of sight is connected with light. The sense of smell is connected with earth. Without going into the detail of all that. Sense of taste is connected with water. Sense of sound is connected with ether. Sense of touch is connected with air. Just hearing a lecture Prabhupada was describing, we're sitting here and the fan is blowing. How do we know the fan is blowing? We can feel the movement of air. It's cooling. That's because the air is moving, and so the sense of touch is made possible through air, or movements of air. Anyway, this is the Vedic way of examining things is, you know, through a particular lens. Doesn't mean that you can't have another explanation. But the Vedic way of looking at things is through that lens of Sankhya. And it's Krishna's system, so we like it. And back to the trees have sight. Well, they can detect where there's light. I mean, I've done this before. You have a plant near a windowsill, like, you know, window, and the leaves are reaching for the light of the sun. So you turn the plant around, so it's away from where the sun is, come back in time, and it's turned, it's towards the sun again. What does that mean? So now, mechanistic science would say, no, it's not sight, it's photosynthesis, and it's just responding to the, you know, where survival and the light will come and da 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 da. So, you know, the Vedic paradigm is, yes, that behavior is there. You can look at the mechanism of how the behavior manifests itself, but behind the behavior there's consciousness. And anyway, from Moksha Dharma section of Mahabharata, trees can see, it's the sight is based on light. And smell is based on earth without an explanation of what that is. So now the first paragraph. In the previous verse, it was explained that living entities should be honored by charitable gifts and friendly behavior. And in this verse and the following verses, the description of different grades of living entities is given so that one can know when to behave friendly and when to give charity. For example, a tiger is a living entity. part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the Supreme Lord is living in the heart of the tiger, a super soul. But does this mean that we have to treat the tiger in a friendly manner? Certainly not. We have to treat him differently, giving him charity in the form of prasad. The many saintly persons in the jungles do not treat the tigers in a friendly way, meaning you go and embrace them and pat them on the head. That's not the appropriate behavior. But they supply prasad foodstuffs to them. The tigers come, take the food, and go away, just as a dog does. According to the Vedic system, a dog is not allowed to enter the house. Because of their uncleanliness, cats and dogs are not allowed within the apartment of a gentleman, but are so trained that they stand outside. A compassionate householder will supply prasad to the dogs and cats who eat outside and then go away. We must treat the lower living entities compassionately, but this does not mean that we have to treat them in the same way we treat other human beings. The feeling of equality must be there, but the treatment should be discriminating. Just how discrimination should be maintained is given in the following six verses concerning the different grades of living conditions. I mean, it's not a book on, you know, how to treat other living entities. It's six verses. In other words, it's principles. And, you know, a little common sense always helps when applying principles. But the how respect is to be shown in compassion and friendly dealings from the previous verse is according to consciousness, and corresponding to consciousness, life forms are awarded. The process of evolution of species, according to the Vedic picture, works like this. We'll start with the human form of life. It's not where living entities start. Prior to the human form of life, the law of karma is not enforced. Rather, because consciousness in the human form of life is more evolved than the other life forms, then that evolved consciousness provides the human form of life, and because that the facility, this facility of achieving the topmost opportunity of consciousness where the living entity is provided, self-realization is facilitated through the human form of life. With that facility then comes responsibility, meaning karma. So there's karma that's elevating, there's karma that's degrading. And if one is just ignores, like last night at MIT, that one of the opening presentations on the slide was a permissive society that says hedonism, that is unregulated. If it feels good, do it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. So just enjoy, because you don't know how long you're going to live. Unrestricted, there's sense power, there's higher intelligence, you can manipulate matter to create facilities for sense enjoyment. Go, go, go. And if the human form of life is not utilized for elevation of consciousness, the default position is the end result is consciousness will be degraded or further covered. And when consciousness becomes degraded or further covered, then from the human form of life, a lower form of life. Now what happens in the lower form of life is then consciousness is more covered. No new karma is accrued, but the existing karma is gradually burned. And then as that karma is gradually burned in that form of life, then consciousness lifts, and then another form of life is awarded to correspond with that more elevated consciousness, and so on, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, till again coming to the human form of life. And then in the human form of life, again comes facility. And with facility comes responsibility, and the law of karma applies again. So what's being advocated, we'll see in the course of the next six verses, gradations of consciousness. There's several places in the Bhagavatam. There's a really nice description in Lord Chaitanya's discussions with Sanatana Goswami in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where those stages of consciousness are, you know, amongst all living entities. Some are regulated. It's like a pyramid, and then it keeps going up and up and up, and the highest stage of consciousness is kind of what's going to be happening here too. Kapila Dev wants us to understand what's the goal. When we get on the train, where's the train going? What's the destination? This interesting experience in China. They put me on a train without anybody that spoke English, no translator, riding on one of those speed trains that goes 134 kilometers an hour, riding from Guangzhou to Wuhan. And I didn't know where to get off. I knew it was Wuhan, but the signs are in Chinese. So fortunately, you know, one of the persons sitting in front of me, he spoke a little English, and, you know, Wuhan, tell me when to get off. Because otherwise 134 kilometers per hour going to the, whatever the next city is. So if we know the destination, Prabhupada speaks like this many times. When you know what the goal is, it's very easy to take steps to get to the goal. Conversely, if you don't know what the goal is, how are you going to get there? We're lost in a maze of complex options, and some people saying it's over here, it's over there, it's over there. We don't know. Try this and try that. So Kapila is teaching what the goal of consciousness is. Very, you know, in different iterations or different versions. Different perspectives, what the goal of life is. Because the core question, going back five chapters, that Devahuti has asked is how to become free from undue material attachment. Specifically, in her case, because her husband has left, family attachment. But if that's an application, it's attachment to matter, or what Bhaktivinod Thakur writes in Harinam Chintamani, he uses this phrase, asat trishna, trishna with a T. Trishna means thirst, thirst for the impermanent, trying to be the enjoyer of the temporary, asat trishna. And there's the conditioning is such that we have a very strong attachment, not just, you know, maybe, but attachment to enjoying the temporary, enjoying illusion, and trying to be the enjoyer of that which is not. Or now you see it, now you don't. Here it is, and then it's gone. So, hankering and then lamenting. That's the material program. And in between, some contact of senses with objects, saying, ah. And then it's gone. And even the ah is part of, on a transcendental sense, the misery of a living entity, because that higher consciousness becomes then covered. The real happiness becomes covered. It's self, evident. Self-delusion, self-abnegation, you know, we lose ourselves in the pursuit of asat, or temporary. We're lost to our true identity and our true happiness. That's unfortunate. So that's the fundamental question that's now covering so far six chapters by Kapila Dev, and here's another little section describing gradations of consciousness. Now, so living entities, back to the verse, living entities, the jiva, is superior to dull matter. We know that from Bhagavad Gita, right? There's para and apara prakriti, chapter 7, verses 3 through 5, I think, or 4 through 6, something like that. There's the eight material elements, and that's prakriti, material nature. Then there's para, or transcendental prakriti, transcendental energy of Krishna, that's living entity. Transcendental because he's conscious. And then there's the controller of both, matter and spirit, and the controller of both. So some people don't make a distinction between matter and spirit. And some people don't make a distinction between matter and spirit and the controller of both. But Bhagavad Gita does. And aspiring transcendentalists guided by Kapila Dev here are doing that also. So there's matter, inert, dull matter, not conscious. And we're not like criticizing the floor, but it's just not conscious. And then there's the soul. The soul is conscious. There's a distinction between those two. And then there's souls that are within matter where there's no apparent life symptoms. He's giving as an example mountains that seem to grow. Although slowly they seem to grow. Now geologists will give a different explanation, and the Bhagavatam gives the reason the mountain is growing, you know, measurably over a period of time, is living entity is within. Then there's others that grow more quickly. And then there's another, the next distinction is developed senses. It doesn't mean, well, the senses of, using this example from the purport, the senses of a tree are less acute or less developed. Consciousness is less developed in a tree than in other life forms. But there's a progressive manifestation of sense perception as consciousness grows. And we're going to hear some of the other ones. So in Vedic culture, the various life forms are to be respected, including trees. Now, material culture may or may not. Just a little anecdotal thing. One of the places that I travel is to Portland, and the temple president of Portland lives in a small town called Oswego. It's the same town that Mother Jamuna was born, in Oregon. And there's a town law. If you want to build a house, you can't cut down trees. You got to build your house around the trees. No tree cutting. No tree cutting. And they can make exceptions. They can let you cut a tree, but you got to get a permit to cut a tree. So it's like, well, very beautiful. Very beautiful. And somehow the houses aren't funny shaped. They're usually, you know, with normal corners on the houses, but somehow they've made houses that don't require cutting trees. Or, I can't recall the history, but there was some history in Vrindavan. Yeah. So as far as I can recall, some of you have been to Vrindavan, and in the courtyard of Vrindavan temple, there's a tree right in the middle of the courtyard. And the devotee that was responsible for making the architectural design wanted to know from Prabhupada if they could cut the tree to build the temple. He said, no. Can you build around the tree? The tree is in the courtyard. And then it was like a small tree. It was a tamal tree, a blackish bark outside tree. And it became, you know, blessed because kirtan every day, you know, they have a 24-hour kirtan, that tree is going, you know, Hare Krishna. Blessed by hearing. And so, trees are to be respected. They're dealt with in a way different than you might deal with, you know, a human, but nonetheless respected. That's Vedic culture. And again, it can go outside of Vedic culture, you know, for different reasons, because they're environmentally friendly kind of thing. But how to take that consciousness and elevate it to a transcendental consciousness? Contact with transcendental teachings, like here. So the summary is, when offering respect, these two, I use this word respect, it's service and charity. Friendly exchange and charity. Because Kapila said that all living entities should be treated in that way. Friendly and charity. That's transcendental life. I'm just thinking of, I'll end with this. There's two really nice, it could take, you know, a whole hour and a half to go through the whole Leela. I've done this before. Where, in two situations, Maharsh Parikshit, you know who's Maharsh Parikshit? He's the king who was cursed to die by the bite of a snake bird. He was you know who the Pandavas are? Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Bhima, Nakula, Sahadeva. You know who Arjuna? So Arjuna had four brothers. And the eldest brother became the king. His name is Yudhisthira. And sometime after he became the king, Krishna wanted him to be king, he became king. Krishna left. So the Pandavas were feeling such separation from Krishna, they followed him. But before they left, they entrusted the kingdom, Yudhisthira entrusted the kingdom to the grandson, Maharsh Parikshit. He was their grandson. So he was placed on the throne, and then Maharsh Parikshit became the king. Great king, many chapters in the first canto of Bhagavatam about his life. An unfortunate arranged by Krishna, a situation occurred where he uncharacteristically disrespected a sage, a brahmana, who was in meditation. Details. The son of that sage came to know, and he cursed the king should die in 7 days by a mystical creature, a snake that could fly and would bite the king with poison in his such poison his body would burst into flames. So Maharaj Parikshit was informed by the sage that my son has done this horrible thing. But I want you to know, in 7 days, you're going to die. So Maharaj Parikshit, this is Canto 1. Maharaj Parikshit gave up the kingdom, turned the kingdom over to his son. Janamejaya was his son. And then he accepted the cloth of a renunciate instead of a king, took off his crown and gave it to his son and everything, and then went to sit by the side of a sacred river and invited the sages to come. And when the sages came, he received them, you know, in a fitting manner, because he knew culture, how to receive them. And then he presented to them, please give your blessings that I may always have association of great personalities like you who will speak the message about Krishna. He asked for 3 things. Blessings. May my mind always be fixed upon the personality of Godhead from those activities of hearing in such saintly association as you all. And the third is, if I must take birth again after I die, may I have association of persons like you, may my mind be fixed upon the Supreme Lord, and may I always have a friendly disposition towards all living entities. Now this is a king, who's about to die, asking the benediction from the sages. May I have a friendly disposition towards all living entities, which follows the fixing the mind upon the personality of Godhead. Because how can you have your mind fixed upon the personality of Godhead and not have a friendly disposition towards all living entities who have the Supreme Lord within their heart? Must be. They fit. The other doesn't fit. There's another, much later, that's first canto, in the 10th canto, another person says the same thing. Really nice description, where Krishna leaves Vrindavan to go to the big city, Mathura, where the king lives, because his father, he was living in a village in Vrindavan, taking care of cows. And when he was 12, he was invited by the king, guest of honor, to come to the big city, the big palace, the capital of the kingdom, and take part in a bow festival. So when Krishna was entering the city, one of the persons he met was a florist. And his profession was he would gather flowers and sell flowers. So the florist was a devotee of Krishna. There's details of how that happened. Well, here's how it happened. Florists want to find nice places for flowers. So he heard that there's some nice flowers in Vrindavan. It's not so far from the city, so he went to look for flowers in Vrindavan. And one day, when gathering flowers, he saw Krishna. And when he saw Krishna, he was overwhelmed with just seeing him from a distance. His beauty, his transcendental character was just overwhelmed him. So he would regularly go to Vrindavan and see Krishna from a distance. He became a devotee in that way. When Krishna came to Mathura, Krishna went right to his house. And the florist was in ecstasy. You blessed my family, my home, everything. You placed your feet in my home. And he offered him some, he and Balaram, beautiful garlands. And Krishna said, you please me so much by your simplicity and your devotion too. So ask for any benediction you like. Anything. And he asked for the same 3 things. May I always be engaged in your service. May my mind always be fixed upon you. And may I always have a friendly disposition towards all living entities. So this, now that's first canto, tenth canto, here's third canto, saying same thing. Friendly disposition towards all. And the basis of it is not like adjust your mind. It's not like put something and, you know, configure your mind differently. It's not a mental imposition. It's a spiritual vision based on seeing the soul and the Supreme Soul within. At least, you know, as we heard, notionally, and then by progressive practice of devotion to factually see, to factually experience, by Krishna's mercy, clouds move and then you can see the sun. You can see the truth. Progressively, realization comes like that. So now, these are instructions and the practical, going down a little further or in more detail, different stages of consciousness and corresponding different coverings of the soul, and then appropriate to the covering and the consciousness, these acts of charity and the friendly dealings. Very nice. Very practical. Highly philosophical, at the same time, very practical. Okay, any discussion? Yeah.
There is a lot of emphasis, we heard, not today's lecture, but in the previous section on performing deity worship.
Mm.
Now, I know there are deity worship training within ISKCON, and that's more about performing deity worship in the temple context, and therefore it's much more elaborate. So I was wondering, like, is there any kind of training that is offered so that, like, everyone can naturally progressively worship the deities at home?
Not sure. I believe so. We just, during this weekend, or last several days, received a notice from our North American deity worship minister, Jayananda, saying that he had just completed a 3-day, or something like that, seminar in New Vrindavan, because, you know, second time around. And it was so well received, he's, like, enthused to do this. In different places around the country. Previously, he was opposed to the idea because he's a teacher in the Mayapur Academy that goes for 4 months. So he wanted to do it for a month. And then we say, no. Then it was, you know, you could do it for 2 consecutive weekends. And he was saying, well... Now it's 1 weekend. Now, if it's directed exclusively to temple standard deity worship, or if he, I'm sure he could, if he's asked to make presentation that relates, you know, probably to both. Temple standard is this and home standard is that. Because the principles are quite similar, just the details become adjusted. I'm sure he has the skill, and if there was an audience, he'd be willing. How's that for an answer?
I would like to maybe follow up on that.
Okay. Well, just, you know how to reach him, Jayananda?
No.
I'll send you his contact information. Just as an example, he was, during Balaram's appearance day, there was, I'm pointing to New Jersey, he oversaw, he approved the deity installation of Radha and Shyamasundar, and he oversaw the program, but he wasn't even like the main priest, he just oversaw it, because he knows what needs to be done. He teaches it. He knows how, what needs to be done. There was a whole setup there. So it took, largely it took one day, but you know, those things can take 3 days. And it can take a few hours. You know, you can, like, expand it or contract it. So he understands what are the principles that are essential, what are the embellishments that make it expanded, what are the things that are essential must be there. He knows his stuff. As with installation of deities, it's also worship of deities. And so many things. He's humble. He's nice. He's Brahman. Yes.
The discussion that we had was mountains also have the did we say it has the soul, or did
Prabhupada says, according to the Vedic literature, some mountains that are growing, they are growing because there's a soul present. What soul does that mean? It means my understanding. It's been elaborated elsewhere. My recollection is that some mountains, there's not a soul present. They're not growing, but there's some mountains that are growing because there's a soul present. No, they're like, you know, a dead body doesn't grow. Now geologists have a whole other idea. You know, how do mountains become mountains? That's pretty creative too.
Because we know, at the Mount Everest grows in about half an inch or one inch, if I'm right, every year.
I don't know.
So it's not like all mountains; it's only a specific.
That's my understanding, correct?
Okay.
Don't ask too many details because I don't know too many details.
This is a very new thing that we have learned today. Because what we have heard in the past is.
I know.
Paraphernalia and Golokas have their, you know, conscious. But this is something...
No, that's different. In Goloka, the bodies, there's not a soul within the bodies in Goloka. Here, there's matter that covers the soul. In Goloka, there's no matter.
Mm-hmm.
Form is spirit.
Mm-hmm.
There's no covering of spirit, no matter. There's no material energy. It's all spiritual energy.
Mm.
Mm. It's very different.
I think I was still associating with what we have here.
Well, you know, I'm not a geologist. I would imagine a geologist has a, you know, cause and effect based upon matter, laws of nature. That's it. There's nothing more. That's their paradigm, and they move within that paradigm, and they don't move outside that paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Period. There's whatever, you know, their language is, there's, what's it called? You know, plates of rock beneath, and then as they shift.
Tectonic plates.
Yeah. So then the pressure of this one against that one is causing the mountain. And if the mountain is growing, it's just the plates that are pressing against one another, causing the mountain to go up. That's all. What's this other idea? You people are silly. It doesn't mean that there isn't place and there's pressure against one another. It doesn't mean, you know, that's... It may or may not be. One doesn't cancel out the other.
Mm.
The fundamental premise is behind everything there's a person. Their material laws are operating because behind them there's an operator. There's a consciousness is behind matter and the movements of matter. Just like laws require a law enforcer. And And according to mechanistic science, no. Laws are primordial. Where did the laws come from? Well, the laws didn't come from anything. They're just primordial. That's God. Laws of nature. That's the cause of everything. Matter and the laws governing matter, there's nothing else. Mechanistic science. And we're spoon-fed from childhood. Here's another mouthful. Here's another mouthful. Through our whole process of education. Mechanistic science. And those people are really powerful. Want to control the textbooks. And what gets on the spoon. What you get fed. They're really powerful people.
Sometimes I think we struggle hard because of those, whatever we've learned since childhood.
Prabhupada, when he translated and published Canto 5, there were lots of questions because the Canto 5 says things other than mechanistic science says things. Prabhupada knew that, and he was like bold about it, challenging about it, intellectually challenging. And the devotees flipped out when they read this and that, and Prabhupada explained that in our present age, more than hedonism as an obstacle for advancing consciousness of Krishna is the blind faith that people have in science. Because when the intellectuals, there's the shudras that don't know how to control their mind and senses. Then there's intellectuals that cast ideas within the whole structure of society. The whole, the scientists are looked up to. I mean, after all, look at what they've accomplished. This and that and the other thing. So if the scientist says it, it must be true. In Tattva Sandarbha, I've been preparing for a seminar on Tattva Sandarbha. One of the sections that is discussed by Jiva Goswami is there are different means of evidence. And one of them is sense perception, pratyaksha, and then reason or inference. And in his commentary, the fallibility, he explains as an example of the fallibility of sense perception and inference or logic is, former president of the United States, Ronald Reagan. Heard his name?
Yeah.
Before he was a president, he was an actor. He was television series. So one of the things that he was commissioned to do was for a TV commercial, dressed in white cloth like a physician, wearing a stethoscope like physicians wear, announcing to the public on a commercial that scientific study has shown that smoking cigarettes is good for you. It's good for your health. It improves your health. Because the scientists at the time, whatever the research they did, perhaps paid by the tobacco industry, concluded that smoking cigarettes is good for you. It's before they knew about lung cancer and all that stuff. But, science says. Or, here's another one. I distinctly remember when I was in high school, there was this presentation of a theory called continental drift. Familiar with continental drift?
Yeah.
So when I was in high school, it was spoken about and then laughed at. Ha ha, those dumb people have this idea of continental drift. Okay, so I learned that in high school. Science says. And then some time passed, and I graduated from college and then read an article where it's a fact. It's not a ha-ha anymore, it's a fact. And anybody that doesn't accept it is ha-ha. It was a 180-degree turnaround. And, you know, in detail describing how it happened. This and that and the other thing. And that's science. You know, sense perception and logic and reason. See, something is inferred. This is the cause of that. It's not disprovable because it happened, you know, before we were born, so we can't know for sure. We go back and see, you know, historical data, but there isn't historical data to prove or disprove. So it just stands in theory, and then somebody else comes along, says, wait a minute, here's some other information that can't be, and then they adjust theory. Anyway, that's science. Etc. So, from the paradigm of Vedic culture, there's a better means of evidence, and that's descending knowledge from a transcendental source, opurusheya shabda, beyond human fallibility, sound vibration, coming from an infallible source, ultimately coming from Narayana, or from God. Or Krishna speaks the Bhagavatam in a nutshell version to Lord Brahma and tells him to expand it. So he does. So that's infallible knowledge about something. Whether it's, you know, the realm of spirit, certainly the realm of spirit can't be known from this realm, and even the realm of matter. How does it work? There's an animating force. There's a conscious entity behind matter. Now, it's a fundamental challenge to mechanistic science. No way. And of course, there's different scientists. When I went to high school, my parents had signed up for American Field Service, AFS, where one student from our school went to study for 1 year in some other country, and somebody from another country came to study in our school. So they signed up to be, to accommodate, to provide a room and board for a student from some foreign country. This was my senior year of high school. So the person that stayed at our home was from Japan. Name was Ken Ijiri. Brilliant. 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 After high school, we graduated and I went off to college and he went off to college, and then I became a devotee and I met him. He contacted me some number of years later, where he had just finished his third PhD. His first PhD was in math, his second PhD was in physics, and his third PhD was in microbiology. And he had just completed his third PhD in University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, in studying the cell division of a frog. One cell becomes two. Math, physics, and microbiology. How does it happen? So he came to visit me in New York. He wanted to see the Statue of Liberty, because he had never seen pictures, but he wanted to go see. I said, I haven't gone to see it either, but I'll go with you. So we're riding in the subway in New York to, you know, go to see the Statue of Liberty. And he was describing, I asked that he describe what he's been doing. And I said, what if the reason for why cells divide has to do with there's a soul that enters and then there's two cells? I didn't say that that's the case. I just said, supposing that's the case, and what would from your research, what would you have to say to that? He gave a very honest answer. He said, we can't even talk about that. It's not within the scope of science that there's some transcendent, he didn't use the word, some transcendental or spiritual cause. We can only examine material cause and effect. Okay, that's an honest answer. Then I was thinking to myself, either he's wasting his time or I'm wasting my time. Brilliant. 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 I mean, can imagine how many papers he's written and how much he knows and brilliant. He wasn't opposed. He didn't say rubbish. He just said we can't talk about it. Science from that perspective. My respect for him stayed way up there because he wasn't saying, no, it can't be. It's not within the paradigm of our discipline, the scope of our discipline to even entertain such an idea or say yes or no. Can't talk about it. So in all that detailed, I can only imagine the detailed physics, math, and biochemistry, or microbiology that he, understanding that dynamic. It doesn't make all of that zero. It says, you know, put a one in front of the zero. If that's the mechanism, methodology by which conscious entity behind matter moves matter, one doesn't cancel the other. But that it's a fundamental distinction. Is there consciousness behind matter or not? It's you know, as far as science, it's a big issue. In fact, you know, there's divisions within science today. They're exploring consciousness. Before, the paradigm was, that's silly. And now they're exploring it. Yeah. Without details. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Is it a wave or is it a particle? And, you know, it depends upon consciousness. It depends on the perceiver. And all of that. You know, theoretical physics and everything. But study of consciousness is now acceptable. At least, you know, some people still, boo. No such thing. Literally, no such thing. Is their idea. So the Vedic wisdom asserts there is consciousness and the seat of consciousness is the soul, and then there's the Supreme Soul that's conscious of all fields of activities. Kshetragya Chapimam Vidhi Sarva Kshetreshu Bharata, chapter 13. In addition to the conscious self, that's conscious of this body, there's another, cha, means and, there's another, sarva, chetreshu bharata, is conscious of all fields of activities. That's a super soul. And that super soul is within the heart of the tree, seeing the tree out the window here, and, you know, the squirrel that's jumping along the fence, and you know, the human forms of life and the insect forms of life, and the super soul is within everything that's alive. And there's a method to realize it. A spiritually scientific method to realize it. Just like, you know, I don't know how to run a computer, pretty much. But some people know how to build them, design them and make new ones and better ones, and so on. So there are things that I don't know mechanically, the things that those people don't know spiritually. There's a spiritual science. you'll, just like the scientific, Prabhupada would speak like the scientific method. There's, what are the four elements? There's a experiment, observation, conclusion. Maybe at the beginning there's a postulation. And then you conduct an experiment and you make observations and you draw conclusions. And it can be repeated over and over and over again, and that's science. So there's consciousness behind everything. And there's the experiment. And then there's the observations, and then there's conclusions. But the experimentation has already been done. And we can do it again. And verify. Or we can just, you know, receive and then continue with the process and gradually experience elevation of consciousness like is described. And it's factual. Consciousness changes. It's like the soul that's conscious within the tree. It takes a long time to get to the next life form, but in the human form of life, consciousness elevation can happen very quickly. And then one starts to see and experience things differently. It's palpable. It's, you know, when you turn a light on, it becomes brighter. You can see more things. And when the light goes down, you can't see as well. You can see something. You turn the light out completely, and you can't see at all. Because seeing is dependent upon light. So illumination of consciousness simply is dependent upon connection with the Supreme. Make that connection with the Supreme. You can see things that you couldn't see before. In the very seat of consciousness, not just with these eyes. The experience of seeing becomes different. Okay, to be continued. Hare Krishna.